So this is a little reading this morning with maybe some brief commentary. If you're not familiar with this, this is called The Mountain Road. It's the Zen Practitioner's Journal, and it's a publication of the Zen Mountain Monastery. And they send it out quarterly. And every issue has a particular theme. And this particular theme was called Living Morality, and it was the winter 2012-2013 edition. So I picked this up last evening before I went to sleep, and I wanted to read something by John Dido Laurie Roshi. I didn't know what this particular said, but it was interesting because it made me go back and look at John Dido Laurie Roshi, who passed away in 2009, I believe, October of 2009. But John Dido Laurie Roshi was born June 14th of 1931. I didn't know this, but I thought about it since maybe he was born in June. I don't know why this was exactly calling to me, but when I looked it up, that in fact he was. We didn't really take any recognition of that this month, so I thought it would be a good time to remember him as a teacher, as someone who's sort of helped further establish and promote the Buddha Dharma in the West. His photograph, one of his photographs, is on the altar this morning. So I'm just going to read a little bit. This is called Right Action, Giving Life to the Buddha. And I'm not going to read the entire thing, but I'll skip around. But it's a good article. It says, most people who study Buddhism are familiar with the enlightenment teachings of Shakyamuni, the teachings of the Four Noble Truths, the doctrine of no self, the principle of interdependent co-origination. Fewer people are aware that Shakyamuni also provided frequent, compelling teachings on a wide range of social and economic issues that impact the general welfare of all life on our planet. He taught about government, politics, and the difficulties involved in mature citizenship and interpersonal relationships, that his teaching extends so dynamically into right action, indicates that the Buddha's wisdom can be appreciated not just in monasteries, but also on the streets and in the households of the 21st century. As we navigate the moral and ethical dilemmas of modern life, the Buddha's teaching can provide a way to see our way home. Indeed, the precepts of the Buddha can transform that navigation into something frankly wondrous, the life of the Buddha realized as our own life. One of the central observations Buddha made about the breakdown of the social fabric is that poverty is the chief cause of immorality and crime. Theft, violence, hatred, cruelty, all result from poverty. It seems that ancient governments in India, like many governments today, tried to handle the problem of crime through punishment. They attempted to suppress it. Buddha said that attempts to control crime will ultimately be futile. This kind of control is like building a dam to hold back rising water. The barrier will hold back the water, but the barrier will always need to be there, and there will always be a threat of the water spilling over or sweeping the dam away. Buddha said that if you want to eradicate crime, the economic conditions of the people have to be improved. In the context of the teachings of the Eightfold Path, Buddha helped householders by elaborating on the topic of right livelihood. Besides indicating what trades a person should avoid in order to actualize the innate harmony of this world, he spoke about the qualities one should cultivate in one's work. When a student asked for doctrines that would help in attaining happiness and peace in this lifetime, the Buddha listed 4 points pertaining to one's profession. First, one should be skilled, efficient, honest, and energetic in whatever profession one engages oneself. One should thoroughly master it. Second, one should protect one's income and savings, one's home, the fruits of one's efforts. Third, one should cultivate good friends. people who are honest, faithful, and open-minded, friends who reinforce the virtuous qualities of the Dharma, and fourth, one should find the middle way in dealing with money. Do not be too extravagant. Do not be self-abnegating. Buddha also described four virtues that are conducive to happiness. A person should have faith and confidence in his or her moral, spiritual, and intellectual values. Each one of us should keep these values conscious. We should really know what they are. This is reflected in Zen training today when we make vows to keep the Buddhist precepts and when we periodically renew these vows, making our values conscious and public. The second virtue that Buddha spoke of is that people should abstain from destroying life, stealing, cheating, and falsehood, adultery, and intoxicating drinks. Further, a person should practice charity and generosity without craving recognition or needing a payoff for good acts. People should also, he taught, strive to develop the wisdom that leads to a complete cessation of suffering. Buddha commented frequently on the pointlessness of war. It is clear that Buddhism does not advocate violence, and its intrinsic message is one of peace and harmony. Buddha not only taught nonviolence, but even went into the battlefield to prevent a war. Buddha was also acutely aware of corruption in government. He knew about the hunger for and the addiction to power and the vanity, intrigue, and malice that could infect ministers and kings. He saw that when officials were corrupt and unjust, the whole country would fall into a state of economic and spiritual decline. In his teachings, The 10 Duties of the King, he establishes guidelines for an effective and just government. What he said about the duties of the king can easily be translated to the duties of a president, a prime minister, the head of a union, the chief officer of a large corporation, or a small business, a legislator, or a judge. It is applicable to that broad segment of society which wields power and in many ways controls the lives of its people. And since all of us, whether we like it or not, take up the koan of power, this teaching applies to each of us as we realize our responsibility to this great earth and to one another. The first of the 10 duties is to be liberal and generous in giving, to be charitable. A ruler should not be attached to the wealth accumulated through position. Rather, it should be given away for the benefit and well-being of all people. Just want to digress it there for 1 minute. I don't know if any of you ever have seen, I think it was the movie Lawrence of Arabia, where Anthony Quinn plays this desert leader. And he talks and he says, he refers to himself as a river unto his people. And I love that line that he said in that movie, if you remember that, a river unto his people. So, a ruler should not be attached to the wealth accumulated through position, rather it should be given away for the benefit and well-being of all people. Second, a ruler should be of high moral character and follow the precepts. Third, a ruler should be ready to sacrifice everything for the good of the people. He or she must be prepared to give up personal comfort, status and fame, even life itself, in the interest of those being served. This is a pretty extraordinary teaching. What would it be like if the highly visible figures in the life of a nation started to set examples of moderation and humility rather than excessiveness and arrogance? What would a model of such high moral standards do for a nation? Just another brief divergence. There was the leader of Uruguay currently is an interesting fellow. I remember reading an article not too long ago, but apparently he had a rather long history, and for many years he was actually a prisoner because he had been involved in a rebellion against the previous government. But now that he's the president, he has the opportunity to live in this very, very extravagant, beautiful palace that they have. But he decided that actually for himself and his wife, he would just continue living in the same house that he had been living in previously and continue to tend the same garden that he did. And I don't know, it was a very interesting, you know, pretty fascinating story of this particular person. I mean, he was sort of an example of this moderation and humility that I think is being talked about here. The fourth duty of a ruler is honesty and integrity. A ruler must be free of fear and favor in discharging the duties of office. There must be sincerity of intention and a commitment not to deceive the public. Fifth, a ruler must manifest kindness and gentleness and possess a genial temperament. Sixth, a ruler should enjoy austerity in personal habits, leading a simple life and not indulging in luxuries, exercising self-control. Seventh, a ruler must bear no grudges and be free from hatred or ill will. The eighth duty is to actualize nonviolence, which means not only avoiding harming anyone, but also actively promoting peace, preventing war, and opposing any activity that involves violence and destruction of life. Ninth, a ruler must practice patience, forbearance, tolerance, understanding, and be able to bear hardships, difficulties, and insults without becoming angry. And the last duty is non-opposition or non-obstruction. The ruler should not oppose the will of the people, but should be in harmony with the welfare of all. All of the Buddha's teachings are really none other than the precepts, the vow to give life to the Buddha, to return to the heart of being. Anytime we renew our precept vows, we renew our ability to practice them more vigorously. Practicing them does not mean never violating them. It means practicing them, and like practicing the breath, we are always starting new, starting fresh. This is right action. When you practice the precepts, you create an energy around you that is palpable to others. I just want to read this one last sentence again, because it did strike me. Practicing the precepts does not mean never violating them. It means practicing them, and like practicing the breath, we are always starting new, starting fresh. What struck me about that was the idea of when we sit and we practice and we sit and we breathe and follow our breath, there's something very routine about that. And so the way it's stated here and the attitude is we are always starting new and starting fresh. Every breath is fresh. Every breath is new. And I think that's a real sort of startling way to look at it. I mean, if you can live with that attitude, that's a beautiful thing. It's not like, okay, breathe, breathe, breathe. But every breath itself is new. It's a start. It's new life. Each time you breathe, it's new life. It's a pretty radical way to be. And when you practice the precepts, you create an energy around you that is palpable to others. This practice is contagious. Zazen is contagious. Living the precepts is contagious. Realizing the ground of being and actualizing it in our lives is contagious. Your practice transforms not only you, but all those who come in contact with you. We have a wonderful gift at our disposal in these teachings of the Buddha. We should vow together that this gift will continue to heal and nourish all beings for countless generations to come. In making that vow, we realize the Buddha's precepts, we realize the heart of being as our own heart, and the heart of all beings. Thank you.